What do? I do exactly the same thing. Conditional acceptance upon proof of claim. Sure, I'll do what you tell me to do. Just please, will you please define, just make sure, tell me please that you're a judicial constitutional court and that the jury, please define the word jury as you're using it and so on. And finally, assure me that the jury is a constitutional jury that is apprised of its right and duty to decide the law as well as the facts. Well, I'm home free. I mean, I haven't gotten an answer.
You've already said so much right there that you'd never, ever be on a jury.
That's right. Well,
they want people that are just so dumbed down and uninformed as to what's going on. You've already demonstrated you have a brain in your head, so there's no way you'd ever get on a jury saying those things.
Well, that's right, but I mean that the way to do it, if I were to say, I don't know what they do actually about jury duty, they probably just forget about it, but if I were to say, no, I'm not going to do that, and I'm not, if I were to defy them in some way, if I were to argue with them or defy them and so on, they probably could do something unpleasant to me. But they can't do anything if I say, sure, I'll do it. Just clarify a few points for me, will you? I'd like to make sure that the jury I'm being asked to serve on is the kind of jury that I want to be serving on, the kind of jury that Jefferson.
I don't think you have much of a chance of being on a jury. You're wasting their time and your time by going down there.
Well, I mean, I'm not.
I mean, you'd be if we had an honest jury system, I mean, you'd be great to be on a jury. But
at the end, you know, you make your at the end of a statement like this. There's a form to it and a structure to it, and people are using it. I'm not the only. I didn't invent it, and I'm not the only guy using it by any means. But at the end of it, you say you have 10 days to answer on a point-by-point basis and with the statements true, correct, and complete under penalties of perjury. And if you don't answer within 10 days, then it's going to be assumed that the points that I've made stand as truth in commerce and that you're going to be stopped from proceeding any further legally on this matter. And that's it. I mean, that's it. You should send them another notice, you know, at the end of 10 days. You should say, now you've defaulted and so on. You always offer them more time if they need more time with the original notice. Anyway, this is a little complicated, and it probably is.
I hope you have good luck in contacting them. Well, Tom, I'm getting towards the end of the show here. I only got just a few seconds left. So
I'm out of here. Thanks so much, Tom, and I really think this will be useful for people. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, can I give my number?
Sure, real quick.
454-9392, if anybody's heard anything interesting and would like to follow up.
Thank you, Tom.
Very much, Tom.
Well, great. Well, folks, getting towards the end of the show right here. Again, the article that I was discussing is the middle section of the Connections magazine. It's called The Meridian and has many articles that I think are just really pertinent to what's going on these days. I didn't get a chance to go into what Ron Paul had to say about all this. Perhaps I'll start out next week's show at 7 o'clock Monday. Thank you. So I talked with Alana, so she said the 9th for on down at KFCO.
Okay, that's the 9th of August?
Yes. So I'll email if that's okay with you.
Okay. Okay, thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, if you would like to call us, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, and we'll invite your calls about half hour. And but right now we have with us on the line our good friend, Dave Wagner. And Dave is going to be speaking there, and he's going to be in Portland tomorrow at 7 o'clock at the Ramada Inn at the, in Portland. And, of course, then he's going to be, I guess, Friday there in Spokane at the Ramada Airport Inn at 7 o'clock. Is that right, Dave?
That's right. And if there's any in northern Washington listening, I'll be in Billingham on Thursday night, too. So.
All right, fine. Whereabouts? How would, is there a number they could get? The...
Well, I think the best thing is to call my 800 number, and we can get them the address. That's my, we'll get back to them right away, the 800 number that I have, and then we'll give them all the details.
Well, okay, fine. Why don't you get that 800 number right out right now?
Okay, it's 1-800-959-1991, and need no addresses or directions or anything, call that number and we'll get back to you by phone.
All right, fine. Well, Dave, of course, had a very good paying job. I believe it was Dow Corning. Gave that up many years ago with a wife and four children to go out across America to try to educate them about what is going on in our society and the fact that we are moving rapidly away from freedom towards tyranny. And behind that, of course, is the dark, sinister spirits of forces, the agents of the prince of this world, who are intent upon destroying America, destroying Western civilization, destroying mankind. We're really involved in a spiritual battle, which most people don't recognize. They put the church to sleep. The average Christian says, oh, nothing bad's ever going to happen to me. I'm going to be raptured out of here before things get bad. And, well, I hope and pray that they're right, but what happens if they're wrong? And, of course, what happens if the rapture comes about 30 years after America's fallen? But there's so many people who've been taught a gospel that says, oh, we shouldn't object when our government is doing all these corrupt and wrongful things. And when the government, of course, is basically pushing evil edicts, we're to worship them because God put them in power. And, well, if our founding fathers had believed that, we'd still be British subjects. They said when, of course, the government was to serve God, and when our leaders were not serving God, why, of course, at that point, we were not to certainly to obey them. In fact, it was John Knox who said that opposition to tyrants is loyalty to God, or words to that effect. So you have to understand there was a completely different attitude towards freedom and towards God and country 250 years ago when the foundations for our Republican form of government were being laid following the first Great Awakening. And what most Americans have forgotten is that America had pretty well turned against God by 1840. And then along came a man named Jonathan Edwards. And Jonathan Edwards, giving a talk in every community he could get to, the same talk, didn't vary. It was a sinner in the hands of an angry God. And one or two other ministers giving similar sermons that man was responsible to God, and of course we were responsible for what we did. It wasn't, well, you know, once we're saved we can do whatever we want to. We don't have to be involved. We don't have to be concerned. And in that sermon, a sinner in the hands of an angry God, were the seeds of the first great awakening in America, out of which came the American Revolution. But you know, people have forgotten that, haven't they, Dave? People take our freedom for granted as if it's, well, we could never lose it.
That's very unfortunate, too, Dr. Stan, that they have done that. I mean, there's various other non-Christians like Edwards that said, all it takes for evil to triumph is good people to do nothing.
That was Edmund Burke.
Spokesman
at the time.
And probably the greatest one was Jesus Christ. He said, when the salt has lost its savor, it's become good for nothing except to be trodden under the foot of the Gentiles. So he calls us the salt of the earth, those that would stand up for truth and righteousness. And unfortunately, a lot of people have either become so caught up in the cares of the world or love of the world or maybe just fearful. I don't know what the motives behind it, but there definitely is a lethargy across this whole land, Dr. Stan, that at will, unless this nation wakes up, unless there's a revival across this nation and turning back to God, I believe that this nation is destined to be destroyed just like any other great nation.
And I think it's going to come very, very rapidly because, of course, we're going out as other great nations, as ancient Greece did, as ancient Rome did, engaging in all sorts of wars. This is a just war. We're here to bring democracy to the people. And we're here, of course, to overthrow this ruthless tyrant. Of course, it doesn't matter that Saddam Hussein worked for the CIA back in the 1950s, and certainly there's every indication that he worked with the CIA all during the 1980s, and at least according to the book See No Evil by Robert Baer that we carry, he was a CIA agent working in Iraq in the mid-1990s and 1995. He said certainly everybody in Iraq believed that the United States was keeping Saddam in power, and many believed he was a CIA agent. Now, that may seem pretty absurd, but if you want to check about his CIA connections back in the 1950s, the book is Holy Babylon. You won't be able to get it. It was written a long time ago. But, of course, years ago, people were a lot smarter than they are today. So, we create the best enemies money can buy, and then we justify going to war. And certainly I hope that the people over there can have a better life. But why are we trying to form a democracy there when America was formed as a republic with limited central power? They want to establish a government with all power. That's what democracy is, whatever the people vote for. Why, of course, the people can have. And under that form of government, it's only a time before they vote themselves into bankruptcy, and, of course, back into slavery. And that's exactly what's happening here in America as we move from a republic under God into a democracy under the rule of the people in the Supreme Court, who obviously have no loyalty to our country because they go to the European Union's Constitution and to the United Nations for direction on how to make a law having to deal with sodomy, which is no business of the Supreme Court. That matters to be dealt with at the state and the local level. And people have forgotten that the whole concept of liberty was to limit the power of the central government so matters dealing with life, liberty, and property would be taken care of at the state and local level. Well, people have forgotten that we are a republic, not a democracy, that our leaders, neither the Supreme Court nor our elected officials, can do whatever they want to. They are to do what they are supposed to do under the Constitution, and that is to recognize that all power not specifically given to Congress under the Constitution or reserved to it by the states is to be reserved to the states and to the people. Boy, when was the last time you heard that we should have limited central government?
Boy, Dr. Stanley, it looks like you're reading my mail or something. I'm up here in Oregon, and I'm looking at a slide now. I was going to talk about democracy versus republic because this slide here says Rumsfeld argues that unrest often accompanies the forming of democracy. He's talking about the unrest in Iraq, and in the paper I picked up this morning, it says seeds of democracy are sown as a new governing body meets its first test. So, again, the deception goes on and on. As probably most of the listeners know that have the Constitution, they know that Article 4, Section 4, it says the Republican form of government is guaranteed to every state government, not a democracy form of government. In fact, the word democracy is not in the Bill of Rights or any Constitution of any state or the United States of America. And again, it's mass deception by Rumsfeld making that kind of comment. I'm looking at a training manual of Dr. Stan from 1928. This is training manual 2000-25. And just to show you this was a definition given by our own Department of War in November 30th, 1928. And this is what they said about, concerning a democracy. It says, attitude towards property is communistic, negating property rights. Now listen to the definition of property as far as the republic goes. It says, attitude towards property is respect for laws and individual rights and a sensible economic procedure. And again, Dr. Stan, there's mass deception going on every day in the papers by both parties, whether it be Republicans or Democrats. In fact, during George Bush's acceptance speech, he called America a democracy. Al Gore called America a democracy in his the time he accepted defeat. And it's interesting that these men, you would think they knew what a democracy was all about. You'd think that in under a democracy form of government, in fact, this is what one of the writers in the Orange County Register said: democracy can lead to tyranny, and it surely can, and it will. And that's exactly what I believe they're moving towards in Iraq and in every other country. I've got a collage of different slides that I'll show at these presentations, and in that collage everybody's talking about a democracy, whether it be Bush or Putin calls on KGB heirs to defend its democracy, and so now Russia's democracy. And of course, the thing is,
David, that if you go back and read the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx wanted democracy. Why? Because he knew that was the means of defeating our republic. If you could give all power to the central government, then, of course, all you had to do was control the duly elected representatives by money and graft and promises, or simply eliminate those who didn't go along. And the people would say, whatever our elected representatives do, these laws we must obey. The Endangered Species Act, we must obey it, because after all, it's the law of the land. How did it become? Well, it was enacted. Of course, the elected representatives had no idea how it was going to be enforced. But, of course, the Supreme Court, corrupting their oath to uphold the Constitution, have allowed it to be expanded to take away the right of private property and the freedom of the individual. Because they understand, these people who've been appointed to the Supreme Court by both the Democrats and Republicans, that if we can centralize all power in Washington, D.C., then, of course, we can have a ruling oligarchy. And that's what it's really all about. That's why people of great wealth, like the people who control the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, so many of the other great foundations, are pushing this idea of socialism and that we are a democracy, so that you can have the centralization of power, and then, of course, the finest politicians money can buy. And you will have then the people who have the funding buying and selling the politicians, and, of course, ruling the masses. It's a return to feudalism, and the average individual doesn't understand, because they don't understand the difference between a republic and democracy. And let me just comment, I was just reading my November 2000 newsletter, and if you have access to your computer, go to my website, radioliberty.com, and look up our November 2000 newsletter, and we explain to you what a democracy is, what one time was taught in every school and every university, and today is never mentioned. Why? Because, of course, they know once we can convince the American people that we are a democracy, then, of course, it is only a short step to tyranny.
I don't think I quite finished the comment about George Bush mentioning that we're a democracy and Al Gore. Either they're ignorant of what you just said, Dr. Stan, which I doubt it, or they're part of the problem as part of the deception. And I believe the next step after they democratize the whole world will be a dictator. I believe they'll move into that tyranny where there'll be one individual that will take over the whole world.
And, of course, that is the spiritual explanation for what's going on. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, we don't want to accept the spiritual part of that. I mean, we want to understand this just like as the wicked men who want power. But behind those wicked men who want power are spiritual forces which energize their decisions. And I don't know what George Bush believes. I don't know what Al Gore believes. But if they don't know the difference between a republic and democracy, they're really dangerous if they do, and they're lying to the people. And I don't think that George Bush really understands the difference between a republic and democracy. Because when I interviewed him, the man sitting next to me asked the president, who man who today is the president of the United States, at that time he was the governor of the state of Georgia, and John Stormer was sitting next to me, and said, well, governor, if you were given a piece of legislation dealing with education or finance that was unconstitutional, would you sign it? And the man who today is the president of the United States said, I don't understand the question. And so the John Stormer rephrased the question. Well, if you were asked, this was a piece of legislation dealing with educational, and it was unconstitutional, and it was brought to you, it passed both houses of the legislature, would you sign the legislation? He said, I'll have to think about that. And that is why we're in trouble today. He came up afterwards to John, and I was standing with him, and said, you know, that was a very good question. I'm going to have to go home and think about that. Now, If our president doesn't understand the Constitution that he has sworn to uphold, maybe that's why we're in so much trouble today. Maybe he doesn't understand that it doesn't matter whether the Congress or the people who control our Congress want to do something. If it is not in the purview and the right of our Congress to enact that legislation, then they shouldn't be enacting it and he shouldn't be signing it. Then the Supreme Court should say that's unconstitutional. Of course, all of them seem to be acting together to increase government power rather than restrict it.
Yeah, well, all the writers, maybe they don't understand it, or maybe none of Bush's staff members understand it, but I'll guarantee you this one, Walter Williams, the syndicated columnist, he does, because he says democracy leads to tyranny.
Right.
So, again, I believe that's the move we're going towards. I believe... I guess we're going to keep our troops. I saw in the papers since I've been on this trip, we're going to keep them in Iraq 4 years plus. Again, there's still threats against Iran and Syria, as was put in place, in 1997. Just so much deception, Dr. Stan, and most of the Americans that just don't have a clue. I guess they're so caught up in the All-Star games probably tonight that they're playing on TV and all the other things, that the sporting events and the moment that they're caught up in, that they really don't understand or they don't care. And God's word says, "My people perish because of a lack of knowledge." And I believe the American people are just totally a state of blindness, just total blindness of understanding what's about ready to happen to this nation. And that's why I travel around, Dr. Stan. I actually travel around hoping that just one person at each one of the presentations may wake up, and one person can make a difference. One person, by dedicating his resources to God, saying, "God, I'll do it your way from here on out. I'll, wherever you want me to go, whoever you want me to support, whatever you want me to do, whatever you want me to say, I'll do it." And that person can affect another life and another life. And that's my hope, as we go around and as we speak on the radio like this, that people will get the vision that we must stand up for righteousness, we must stand up for truth, we must not just continue to ignore what's really happening, because that won't stop the inevitable. And the inevitable is taking our freedoms and liberties and our children's freedoms and liberties and our grandchildren's freedoms and liberties away from them.
Well, I agree with you totally. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, Dave is going to be speaking at the Ramada Inn Airport Hotel in Portland tomorrow evening. He's going to be speaking a couple of nights later in Billingham. He's going to be Friday at Spokane at the Ramada Inn Airport Inn there at the 7 o'clock. There's no admission fee, is there, Dave?
There are no admission fees for any of them. I just appreciate people that would take the evening to find out what possibly can happen to them and their grandchildren. Let me just give out a number in Billingham in case they don't have time to call my 800 number. There's a number up there, 360, if you're in the Billingham area listening, 360-734-0193. There's a Ben there at that number that will answer or give you directions how to get to the meeting at 7 o'clock on July 17th, that Thursday evening.
All right, that's 360-734-0193. If you know anybody in the Bellingham area, why, give them a call. And Dave does a wonderful job of bringing God's Word, but, of course, in contemporary language with an understanding of the times, because everything that's going on today has a spiritual force behind it. People say, "Oh, well, this is just man's greed, or this is the way things always go." No, this is not the way they go. This is the way I believe that it's being planned by the dark forces that dominate our society today. You know, there's a famous saying. It comes from, I think it was Dialogues with the Devil. It was probably C.S. Lewis's writings. Something to the effect that two devils talking together, when one of them says to the other one, "When we can convince the public we don't exist, at that time we'll have won." Well, I wonder how many people really believe there's a demonic conspiracy, that the demons are here, that there is a satanic movement to take over the world. And most people don't believe that, because, of course, we don't teach that. Today, a century ago, everybody knew what was going on. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dave Wagner, and we're talking about, of course, the coming trip, and we're talking about, of course, the idea that the average American has no idea of the difference between a republic and a democracy. And, of course, you've all heard that analogy. A democracy is two wolves negotiating with a sheep on what to have for dinner. A republic is a society where there are laws against eating sheep, and when the wolves meet the sheep, why, the sheep is armed heavily, and of course that is the difference. You see, how do we protect ourselves from the wolves in government? Why, of course, they're limited by law on what they can do to take away our freedom. And, of course, that is increasingly being restricted. And, of course, the chains that were originally put on to the executive branch and the legislative and judicial branches of government have been taken off. They're being fashioned for the people as we return from freedom to feudalism, to serfdom and slavery.
Dr. Stan, I just finished a presentation in Santa Rosa, and the leader there, she's a well-educated woman and very beautiful, really neat lady. We talked afterward on the phone, and she said, you know, how come they put all those clips? Because I do show video clips, and how come they put all that information on television and on the radio? And I said, well, it's mainly a desensitization. It's a gradual, just letting you know a little bit here and a little bit there. She said, well, when I see the entire thing put together the way you do put it together, she says, it really can be fearful, and I told her, well, and I, as I told them, tell everybody at the presentations that it's not designed to be fearful, because that's what the enemy would want, that's what Lucifer would want, is to bring on fear and paralysis, but it's designed as a wake-up call, as we're all called to be watchmen. In Ezekiel 33:3, it says, when we see a problem coming, if we fail to warn the people, the blood will be upon our hands, but if we warn them and they do nothing, then it's on their hands, that's our responsibility. I think if we love people and care about people, we will tell them the truth. We won't continue to perpetrate the lies that are being perpetrated through the press daily. And that's why I appreciate being on your program and the information you put out every day, Dr. Stan, that I can be part of that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Just before we came to the studio, my son was saying that he'd seen a preview for a new blockbuster movie that's going to be coming out. It's called... it deals with the satanic rituals in the Vatican, in the Vatican in Rome. Now, that may seem horrible for you, and especially if you're Catholic, and I'm not saying this to demean Catholicism. I'm pointing out that the Catholic Church has been infiltrated by the dark side. In fact, I think it was Pope Paul VI who said, the smoke of Satan circulates above the Vatican today. And, of course, most people don't like to think about that, but it really is true. If you've read Malachi Martin's wonderful book, A Windswept House, of course, it's put in a fictional form, but it opens with a satanic ceremony in the basement of the Vatican. I asked Malachi Martin off the air, is this really true? And he said, everything in the book is true. I've changed the names, and the dates on a few things, but basically this is true. And he was talking about the homosexuality in the church, and many of the cardinals he talked about are the ones we find now that have been protecting the homosexuals. If you haven't heard our four tape set on the wisdom of Malachi Martin and how the current pope got to be the pope, you really need to get that four tape set. It's called The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. But we're going to be back here in just a moment. We have Scott from Coeur d'Alene who's with us, and we're going to be talking about republics and democracy. Our number 1-888-24 Liberty, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and we've got Scott calling from Coeur d'Alene. Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
Hey there. I'm doing just fine.
Okay. You want to comment on our discussion on republics and democracies?
Yes, sir. I was just listening to y'all's program, and I was hearing a lot of talk about nobody knowing the difference between a republic and a democracy, and I'm one of those people, and I would love to hear your all's explanation of the difference.
How much time you got?
I got plenty of time.
All right, fine. Well, basically, I'm going to let David, can you give about a three-minute description of the difference between republic and democracy, David?
Well, the democracy is where the masses rule, basically, and when the masses learn that they get something for nothing, they'll usually vote in a person that will continue to give them something for nothing. And It wasn't designed to be that way. It does away with productivity. It does away with desire for productivity, because it's from each according to his ability. That is basically the socialistic democratic type thinking. It's each according to his ability, from each to each according to their need. And that's pretty much what democracies end up. They end up in mobocracy. They end up with no property rights. Again, the manual that I had mentioned earlier was a training manual put together, and it definitely, if you come out, you're in Coeur d'Alene, if you come out to that Spokane meeting on the 18th, you'll actually see that manual. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had all those manuals seized and destroyed because he knew that people would be informed of what the difference was, and they wanted to lead us towards this democratic rule, which will lead towards tyranny, is what it will.
All right. Let me just tell you, first of all, Scott, if you read the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, you will never once see the word democracy mentioned other than to decry it and say, we don't want a democracy, we want a Republican form of government. And James Madison, of course, who was the fourth president of the United States, wrote about democracies. And, of course, he pointed out that democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention. Democracies are air incompatible with the rights of private property and of personal liberty, and they're short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. Now, you'll find that in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, but I bet you never learned that in school, and don't feel bad, because I didn't either. What's wrong with a democracy? Well, first of all, I think Alexander Tyler said it best in writing probably 25 years before the Constitution. He said this: a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until a majority of the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. And from that moment on, the majority always votes for candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy and is always followed by a dictatorship. That's what our founding fathers said, and if you'd like, we can put you on hold at the end of the program and get your name and address. I'll send you a copy of my November 2000 newsletter, which really lays... Do you have access to a computer, Scott?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then you look it up, November 2000 newsletter, and the whole thing is there, what Alexander Hamilton said, what, of course, John Quincy Adams said, what all of the founding fathers said about not wanting a democracy. They wanted a republic. Now, with a republic, the power of government is limited by law. Under democracy, why, you have rule by man. Under republic, you have rule by law. Under a democracy, the elected officials can do whatever they jolly well want to. Under a republic, they are limited in what they can do. And that was what the whole idea of taking the chains off the people and putting it onto government, that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous. Which direction do you think we're headed?
Oh, it doesn't look good right now.
It sure doesn't. And so our founding fathers, you know, in fact, the story is told when Benjamin Franklin is leaving the Constitutional Convention, a lady named Mrs. Powell comes up to him and says, what sort of government have you given us, doctor, a republic or a monarchy? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And that was the thing. You see, the concept of republic meant that you had to limit the power of government, but you then had to have moral and religious people. John Adams said our government was made for a moral and religious people. It would not work for any other. Our founding fathers realized that you could have moral and religious people and you could have freedom. You could have immoral and corrupt and deviant people, and then you're going to have a tyrant. And that's why, of course, the Supreme Court has done everything they could to undermine morality. That's why they've done everything they could to undermine the Constitution and to centralize all power with government. That's why they had to get God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, so there'd be no moral foundation, so we would have anarchy, and then you could justify the tyranny. And they've known exactly what they were doing. You could get my November 2000 newsletter, and of course that deals, of course, with democracy. The December 2000 newsletter deals with republics. And after you read those, give us a call back if you have any questions. But under a democracy, why, the government can do whatever it wants to. Under a republic, there's very little it can do. Matters dealing with life, liberty, and property are to be dealt with at the state and local level. That comes from the 45th of the Federalist Papers. Bet you didn't learn that in school, did you?
No, I bet I didn't.
Okay.
Hey, I got one more question for you guys.
Hang on, we've got to take a break. You'll be back right after the break.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Dave Wagner. And, of course, on the line is Scott calling from Coeur d'Alene. Scott, did you have another question for Dave?
I did. I hear what you're all saying about the problems that we're facing. But I think I myself and plenty of others would like to know what sort of solutions we can work towards in creating a better system for ourselves.
All right, fine. Dave, why don't you answer that for him?
And head off the line, and I'll let you guys answer it on the radio. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, Scott, that's a good question because I think each of us have a different calling. As you see Dr. Stan on the radio 5 hours a day, I'm traveling around the country. There are people in each city that have a responsibility to God, the creator of heaven and earth. And I think they're going to have to ask God what they should and shouldn't do, what they should do with the resources they had. I was with a very wealthy man the other day, and he said, "Why am I so fortunate?" And I said, "Well, you might think you're fortunate, but to much is given, much is expected." So those with a lot of resources are going to be held accountable before our Father. And the one thing we do want to do, we want to stand up for truth. We want to stand up for righteousness. We want to stand up for freedoms and liberties for our children. The last thing we'd want to do is see our families go into tyranny. So, again, it's an individual thing. Each of us have a different calling in this world. But one thing we shouldn't do is nothing. I mean, that's the worst thing we can do is just sit back and complain and let somebody else do it as we continue to just take care of the moment details that come before us. I mean, we've got to put a plan, we've got to get a calling, we've got to go out and do it. And there needs to be a lot more people out there. Like Jesus said, the fields are white, but the workers are few. There's very few that are willing to really go out and take their time and their energies and their resources and use them for righteousness. I hope, Scott, you get that, take this to heart and actually ask God what he would have you do. And he'll tell you. He says, "My sheep hear my voice." And I know that it'll be for the good of this country as well as for the good of the future generations as well as your own personal righteousness and your own personal walk with him.
Okay, fine. Well, Scott, we put together a 10-point program, some time ago, and I suppose we really ought to put that up on the Internet. But point number one was to know what America was all about, to learn about point number one was to have a proper relationship with the Lord. That was point number one. Point number two was to understand the Christian heritage, the Judeo-Christian heritage of this country, because, of course, you don't have to be a Christian to be a good American, but you have to understand the Judeo-Christian heritage of this country. You can be a Muslim, you can be a good American. You could be a Jew, and you can be a good American. You could be an atheist and be a good American, but you have to understand the heritage of this country and why America was formed as it was. Now, that's why you need to put together the Institutes of the Constitution. Now, anybody out there in the listening audience can do that. There are well over 100 of them across America. And, of course, the Institute of the Constitution is 12 lectures put together by Dr. Eidsmo that will train people about the heritage of this country, about our Declaration of Independence, about our Constitution, about our responsibility, about the limitations on the central power of government, and, of course, what our Founding Fathers intended. And you do that by calling the Institute, and, of course, I'll get to that telephone number here in just a minute. And, for a minimal cost, why you can set up an Institute of the Constitution in your community, you get people together. And, of course, once people understand the most carefully kept secret in this country and the foundation of our freedom, then they get sort of excited about it and they want to tell other people. And that's how we're getting the information out across America. And then, of course, even more than that, we've got to, of course, get people to understand what the bad guys are doing and understand the spiritual aspects of this battle in which we're engaged. Now, to find out about the Institute of the Constitution, call 410-760-6759. That's 410-760-6759. Set up an Institute of the Constitution. When the majority of the people understand what America is about, when they understand that, of course, most of the things that are going on in Washington, D.C. are unconstitutional, and that we have people who've sworn to uphold the Constitution who don't even know how many articles there are in the Constitution, much less the significance of the Bill of Rights and why it was passed as it was, we can begin electing people to office, of course, who believe in our way of life. But the time is late, And we don't have any time to tarry. You're not going to do it later and accomplish anything because tomorrow may be too late. Today is the day to act. Let's start a reinstituting an understanding of the foundations of this country. And then, of course, once we understand what America was, then we can understand the spiritual forces that motivated the people who are destroying this country. Books like The Foundations, Their Power and Influence, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. In fact, you go to our website and just look at the books we have there. All of them are designed to educate you about what's going on. And then help us in this epic struggle to educate the American people, to convince them that they have an obligation to be involved. Because if we don't, of course, who will? And if not now, when? Let's go to Jeannie calling from, is this Jeannie from Aptos? Hi.
Yes, it is, Dr. Stan. Good evening, and hi, Dave.
Hi, Jeannie. Thank you for everything you sent me.
Okay, I hope you can use it.
I was just getting ready to mention it. It is invaluable. I've already shown it the one presentation, and one thing you do, Jeannie, is you really document the information you've given me, and I really appreciate that.
Well, that's one of the things that Jeannie had sent Dave. I wonder how many people out there have heard what the SS, of course, this was established by Hitler, the Gestapo. The SS was above the Gestapo. It was headed by Heinrich Himmler, and of course he controlled the Gestapo, but the SS, what is the term, and of course Jeannie gets this from a German dictionary, what does the term SS in German mean?
Well, it means Schutzstaffel.
And what is Schutzstaffel?
Schutz is protection, and Staffel is a home defense squadron.
All right, the home defense squadron, like the Office of Homeland Security.
Yes.
Right, isn't it interesting that they would have picked that name for our SS, as it were.
And for our Homeland Security. And we're going to talk about that on the presentations when I travel around. And Dr. Stan, I'm looking, and Jeannie's, I'm sure, familiar with all this, and then I'm also going to talk about the economy, Jeannie, and thank you for that tape you sent on Pete Peterson, the Federal Reserve Chairman there from New York, that clip that you sent me. But I'm looking at USA Today. It says, some families choose lawsuits over federal funds. It says, relatives say goal isn't just money, but it's to get answers about 9/11, and we're going to look at some of those answers about 9/11 and about some other incidents that have taken place, just to show you the people that attend how late we are. The hour is really late, and Jesus said, when these things begin to come to pass, look up, lift up your head, for your redemption draweth nigh. And I believe the day the roosters come home to roost, or there's all kinds of cows come home, or the day of reckoning is coming, there is very soon for this country, unless people across this nation wake up.
Anna, did you have anything else to say, Jeannie?
Well, I did. And, Hester, you were talking about from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And that's really phrased a different way, which is sustainable development, using a certain amount of resources so in the future other people can use the resources and have them. So it's just phrased another way, but I have been looking and critiquing this movie, America with a K, and it was, it started with, after 10 years of occupation with the Soviet Union over the United States, and it's just devastating, just critiquing every sentence and every word, but there was one thing that really stood out. And that was this congressman that actually was sent into rehabilitation camp. Well, when he came out, it had a big sign, and it was an ex-army camp. And so this movie is trying to tell the people 10 years ago, hey, guys, the time is late, and this is what's happening. There was one pledge, this congressman that was rehabilitated, he had to say before he left the rehabilitation office. And I would just like to read this one sentence. And when he did the pledge, there was a big roll down, it was like paper coming down, and they had a picture of the United Nations symbol, and on the right-hand side, looking at it, was the Russian flag, and on the left-hand side was the United States flag. And this was the oath he had to say the congressman as he left the rehabilitation camp. Quote, "I pledge my allegiance to this flag with the community of American, Soviet, and United Nations of the world, and to the principle for which it stands, a nation indivisible with others in the earth, and joined in peace and justice for all."
And of course, this is why, of course, they take any mention of God out of that, and any mention of America, and that is really what's going on in our schools today. If you see what is being taught in our schools, or if you know about the federal tests that are being given now to our students at various stages, the whole purpose of the testing in the public schools today is to destroy love of God, family, and country, and of course to orient our children into believing in this idea of the one world government. In fact, they even ask our children, which gives you the most freedom, the Bill of Rights or the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which guarantees you food and housing. Isn't that wonderful? All these freedoms you get from the United Nations, much more than you get from, our Declaration of Independence. And the whole purpose of current education all across America today is to take the minds of our children and alter their world perspective, going along with this idea of the New World Order and the New World Religion. And the average parent has no idea what's going on, or what their children are learning, or what they are being indoctrinated in their schools today.
So what I see, my last comment, is sustainable development is a joining together convergence of the Soviet Union, communism, and capitalism, the United States.
Do you think that's why Gorbachev and Stephen Rockefeller and Maurice Strong, a multi-billionaire, are all working together there through the United Nations to give us a better world?
And I was going to ask you, Dr. Stand, on Gaither. Remember, he was the president of the Ford Foundation?
Rowan Gaither, yes.
And he was asked by, I forget the man's name that was investigating.
Norman Dodd.
Okay. And Gaither said, We have directives from the White House to merge the Soviet Union with the United States as easily as possible, something to that effect.
Well, we are working under a presidential directive to so alter life in America that we can be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Anybody who'd like to hear that interview with Norman Dodd where he tells that story, it is available in our four-tape set called The Secret Government, along with the interview with Professor Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor. And I think that, but if you'd like to get that interview with, and hear what Rowan Gaither had said, to so alter life in America that one day we can be peacefully merged with the Soviet Union. And isn't it interesting? Now we're getting along so well with those nice Soviets. And, of course, maybe that's why we've consistently found one reason or another, either to funnel massive amounts of money into Russia or massive amounts of money into China. And just read the Wall Street Journal on a regular basis. You'll find either our government or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or American corporations, billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars invested in communist China, and, of course, nothing invested in America. What's wrong with this picture? Why, when are the American people going to wake up to realize, of course, that it all has to do with the New World Order? The coming world order, the coming world religion, where American labor's living standards are raised to that of the Chinese peasant.
Dave, I wanted to thank you for what you're doing, because I know it's hard traveling all around and it's tiring, but that's wonderful. Everyone has a part, and thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you, Jeannie. And I might mention that Dr. Stan has that clip you mentioned about the pledge of allegiance or pledge to the flag of the United Nations and of America and Russia on the front, the very first tape number one of the amazing clips. There's about 10 different real short clip snippets, and that's one of them. You ought to get a copy of that, Jeannie, and just review that. That's it. I really thought that was an unbelievable movie.
Yeah, I'll do that.
But it's on the Amazing Clips, tape number one, that one you just mentioned. And I know you carry it there, Dr.
We do. That's Amazing Clips. If you haven't seen it, why people need to get the information, and then need to get it to others. if they really care what sort of a world their children are going to live in. Jeannie, thank you for everything you do, too.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Now, I want to give you our website, which is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Go there, pull down our letters, and get our information. Dave, let's get out your telephone number for Hope for America Ministries, and if you can get to David's talks tomorrow night in Portland, on Thursday night in Bellingham, on Friday night in Spokane, you want to do it. But if you can't, then how can people get in touch with you?
They can call 800-1-800-959-1991. Leave your name and your address, city, state, and zip code clearly and slowly, and we'll get off a resource packet to you. And if you can't make it to those meetings, most of these are on tapes, as I've done multimedia presentations, about 18 of them now. I'll be doing the one as I go around the next few nights. It's called a Great Deception Update. It's got some, obviously, some new slides, new clips, but I've done one, and you carry it, and I carry it. It's called A Great Deception, so you might want to get that. I've spent about 18 months. It's got about 12 different subjects that are very important, and they're still pertinent to our life as we're continuing to see this plan played out for this global community. And as Jeannie mentioned, that from each according to his ability to each according to their need, that's also the socialistic leveling of the playing field. What they're going to do is they're going to take from the rich, the Americans, and give it to the poor, the Chinese. There will be, under a global community, there will not be one country that has all the wealth of the world and the rest of them that serve those. It will be the very elite people, the very very wealthy international bankers, and these very secretive families that will control the masses, and eventually it'll be a one dictator empowered by Lucifer himself, which will control the entire world.
So. And I think that's really what's so important. First of all, when they talk about redistributing the wealth, they're not talking about redistributing their wealth, not the Rockefeller's wealth, or the wealth of the Ford Foundation, or the wealth of the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, or many of these great, great families that have amassed so much wealth through the years. They want to redistribute the wealth of the middle class to buy the support of other people. You take it away from one group and you give it to another, and that, of course, makes them happy. And of course, so the poor are really not paying very much in the way of taxes. So they're all in favor of raising the taxes on the people above them, so they're going to get more, without realizing that eventually everybody loses everything and is enslaved. This is the way that it always works. And this whole idea of class warfare, and you hear it being espoused all the time, of course, all the taxes are just for the benefit of the rich. Well, let me tell you that, of course, the fabulously rich, the George Soros's, the William Buffett's, people like Bill Gates and the Rockefeller, they pay very, very little in the way of taxes, because all of these tax loopholes are put in, and every time Congress devotes to, of course, close the tax loopholes, they make new ones. And I've got nothing against people being wealthy. I'm all in favor of people being wealthy, but not if they're going to utilize government to enslave the mankind. And that is the great tragedy. One time, people accumulated wealth, but that wealth was not necessarily used, to produce new industry and for stimulate the economy. Many years ago, starting with Cecil Rhodes back in 1891, when he created a secret society, and that's all described in my book and documented in my book, the secret society called, it was just called US initially. It didn't even have a name. But then it was called the Round Table, and then it metastasized to America in 1921 and became the Council on Foreign Relations. And that's described on page 951 and 952 of Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. So now, of course, when you pick up your newspaper and you read about the Council on Foreign Relations, or Condoleezza Rice of the Council on Foreign Relations, or Dick Cheney of the Council on Foreign Relations, or the other people in key positions in our government, Colin Powell from the Council on Foreign Relations, you understand that they are part of a secret society, whether they know it or not. Maybe they don't even know about the origins of the Council on Foreign Relations. I dare say that most members of the CFR are have no idea what it's really all about, other than that they're dedicated to this idea of one world government and doing away with national sovereignty. And the first step is to unite the Western Hemisphere, first taking down the tariff barriers, then a universal currency, then a universal government, just exactly as they're doing in Europe, and then the first merging them all together into this one world dictatorship, and of course, ultimately the ruler. And nobody will tell you this, but the ruler is to be Satan. Isn't that right, David?
Absolutely, absolutely. And do we have time? I'm going to play one clip. I brought these clips along with me, Dr. Stan, on the trip. I'm just going to play one. You can introduce it. It's going to be shown at the presentation, and it pertains to a number of things in the presentation, the New World Order, 9/11, and everything else. But just listen to this clip.
There is a chance the President of the United States used this disaster to carry out what his father, a phrase his father used, I think, only once, and hasn't been used since, and that is a New World Order.
And, of course, that is ex-Senator Kerry Hart, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, addressing an emergency meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations convened just 3 days after the September 11th attack. There is a chance the President of the United States can use this disaster to create what his father spoke of, and I think only once, and that is a New World Order. The President can use this disaster. Now, you have to understand that Gary Hart in 1999 had put out a report from the National Commission on Security in the 21st Century, and Gary Hart was the co-chairman of that, in which he said there are going to be terrorist attacks in America, Americans going to die in American cities. They knew the terrorist attacks were coming. So why, if they knew the terrorist attacks were coming, didn't we stop and cut off the funding to the terrorists? Why didn't we infiltrate their organizations? We did, but they can't let the American people know that. How, if they had not infiltrated the terrorist organizations, how was it that within 2 hours of the attack on the World Trade Center, FBI agents were in the neighborhoods where the terrorists lived, at the restaurants where the flight schools where they trained? How could they do that? That comes from the testimony of Christian Breitfeiser before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the 18th of October, the 18th of September of last year. And if you go to my website, radioliberty.com, pull down the October newsletter. That's the October 2002 newsletter. You can read her entire testimony, which was effectively censored by the mass media in America. October 2002, Kristen Breitweiser's testimony. How was it within a day or two of the 9/11 attack, they'd already arrested 1,000 Muslims, and later they said, well, we can't tell you their names because we wouldn't want the terrorists to know who had arrested, that we disrupted their terrorist cells? No, they didn't want the American people. I mean, you'd have been to tell me the terrorists didn't know that these people had suddenly disappeared from their homes after the FBI came and knocked there? They didn't want the American people to know that they'd had the whole movement infiltrated for years. They knew exactly what was going to happen.
And Dr. Stan, 30 hours after those attacks, Donald Rumsfeld would recommend we go into Iraq. So you'll see how 9/11 is tied into the Iraqi war that's tied into future wars. So it all comes together. It's all a plan put together for just what Gary Hart said there, a new world order, a global community.
I think one of the big things, Dave, is a lot of people say, you're accusing the president of knowing about this. No, I'm not. I'm accusing the people who surrounded him of knowing about it, because they all came from a little clique called the Project of the New American Century. You can go to their website at newamericancentury.org, newamericancentury.org, and find out that in 1997 they were planning the war on Iraq in 1998. Go to their website. They created their organization in 1997. They put out a statement of principles, and they called for the establishment of an international order led by the United States for our profit and our principles, whatever those might be. And in 1998, they were calling on the president to go to war with Iraq. And who was that? Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, all the people who control the president today. He doesn't write his speeches. He doesn't set out the plan. They do, and they're the people I'm worried about. And it's amazing how many of those come from the Council on Foreign Relations, and the fact that the average citizen has never heard of the Project for the New American Century, or the fact that the Council on Foreign Relations is part a front for a secret society that had its roots in the occult. That is what's scary. The American people really don't know any more than I think that George Bush really knows what's going on today.
That short little clip we played about Gary Hart, you could go on to the direction of Schutzstaffel or Homeland Security. You could talk about how Gary Hart and Warren Rudman helped designed that particular agency many years in advance, the decade before, in fact. So,
in fact, that's phase three. In fact, we have all these reports. If you're out there and you want to verify what we're saying, we have the phase one report of the National Commission on the Security in the 21st Century, issued in September of 1999, talking about the terrorist attacks on America, or the report issued in September of 2001, calling for the, well, they didn't call it the Office of Homeland Security. I think they called it the National Security Agency. But, of course, it's exactly what, of course, was suggested immediately after the September 11th attack. It was almost as if they knew it was coming.
Yeah, it appears it was all put together, and I know they're moving. They have been moving towards this Luciferian society, towards this global community. And again, I'll be showing all the clips, how it's going to affect every single American, unless something's done about it, about the personal locator devices, the technology that can enslave the American people today that are already in place, and as well as the concentration camps that are there throughout, at least put on the books in case of a terrorist attack. So.
All right, fine. Now, our guest this evening is David Wegner. He's going to be speaking in Portland tomorrow evening at it's the Ramada Inn, isn't it?
Going to be at the Ramada Inn in Portland. All these are 7 p.m. No charge at the door. Bring a friend. And then also the next two nights later on the 17th, I'll be in Billingham, Washington. You might want to call that number again. Let me get the number for you here. It's 509, excuse me, Billingham is 360-734-0193. And then on July 18th, Friday night, I'll be speaking at the Ramada Inn in Spokane. Lynn Horwitz will be introducing me, so he'll be there that evening too, so you get a chance to talk to him. So come on out to any one of these, and all of them are no charge, and you could go to Dr. Stan's website, I believe, and pick up
it's all on my website,
the locations of every single one of these.
And of course, if you're then you're going from where are you going next after that? You're going into Idaho, aren't you?
Then I'll go to Kamiai, Idaho on the 21st, and then Salt Lake City on the 22nd.
All right, so they're all listed on our website. Go to RadioLiberty.com. You can get David's itinerary and get out there and get people supporting him, because he's doing what I'd like to be doing, but I've got to be here on the radio, so he's got to have all the fun of going out there and talking to people all across America.
I really do enjoy it. I love meeting the people. I mean, they're some of the greatest people, and I really enjoy that part of it, Dr. Stan, that's for sure.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for tonight?
Well, I just really, my prayers have always been for your listeners and for the Americans. The name of the ministry I have is called is Hope for America. I've always prayed for America. I've always had a heart for America. And as I see our liberties and freedoms taken away, I'm really concerned, and I hope that people would get involved. They'd ask God what to do at this late hour. And I know that He'll tell them. I know that He'll direct their path. He says that He will direct our path if we delight ourselves in Him. And I just hope and pray that things can turn around, things can change from where the direction they're going right now. I know it's going to take a lot of people and a lot of different individuals getting involved, and I hope many of the people listening tonight will purpose in their heart or make that choice to do just that.
Well, I just hope you have a great, great turnout, and if you do get to Dave's program, just tell him you heard about it here on Radio Liberty. God bless you. Have a wonderful, safe trip. Keep in touch with us, and until we... Again, may the Lord be with you.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, and all you at Radio Liberty and all the listeners.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is the time we have to just ask you to pray for America. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers. Pray for revival in America. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And if you'd like a free copy of that article on republics and democracies, just call 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, request it. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that is going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the retired Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton, and of course we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Middle East. Now, Colonel Stratton was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on the 6th of August, 1947. He grew up in California and Europe, and of course he completed his schooling in the Monterey area. He graduated from the Seaside High School. He joined the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era, and of course he worked with SOG, Special Operating Groups. He returned to Southeast Asia, served in Europe and various bases in the USA. He served in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia 1982 to 1984, where he designed and trained and fielded the equivalent of our Secret Service for members of the Saudi royal family, served as Chief of Plans and Operations for Headquarters Command in Southeast Turkey from 1985 to 86. So he has a great deal of knowledge of what's going on in the Middle East, and he's completed his 26-year military career, where he worked at Fort Ord and as the garrison commander at the Presidio of Monterey. And then, of course, since he's been retired, he's headed his own business. He took on a specialty draining construction company as general manager and CEO, grew the firm by 1,000% in 5 years, and left that position last spring. He lives over in Monterey with his wife. And the reason, of course, we've asked him to come on, some of our friends had heard him a good talk before a group of Republican women, and somebody called and said, "You've got to get this Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton on, the most fascinating speaker we've ever heard." And when one of our friends calls with such a glowing recommendation, I called Colonel Stratton, he was kind enough to come on. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome, Stan.
Why don't you sort of give us a rundown of what's going on in the Middle East? Because we hear all of these things. We hear about what's happening in Iraq now. We're going to have to keep our troops there for several years more. And then we keep hearing about what's going on in Iran, and Iran is developing nuclear weapons. And we hear about, of course, what goes on in Saudi Arabia, where they certainly seem to have a very autocratic government. There's a lot of trouble over there. And increasingly, we seem to see the radical Islamic movement making headway in Turkey and in Pakistan and of course in Egypt, and it certainly would of course make increased headway in many of these other countries if it weren't that there are dictatorships in power there. So why don't you give us your appraisal of what's going on in the Middle East and how it will impact our listeners tonight?
Stan, what I'd like to do to start that is do a quick review of 7 key countries in the Mideast. They're all predominantly Muslim. We'll take a bi-country look after I do the orientation of them, and we can discuss projections for the future and entertain any questions that you have or the audience might have. The countries are, first of all, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and as you mentioned, I was there for 2 years. They have about 26% of the world's oil reserves. They're cash poor at this time, though, because of the growing population. They, as we now know, are the home of Al-Qaeda, where the Al-Qaeda was born and from which it was projected into other countries and unfortunately into ours, and from where it receives significant funding. It happens to also be the only country without suffrage of the 7 all cover. Iran is the second country, home of Hezbollah, funder of terrorism, probably the premier funder of terrorism in our time. Iran is also facing severe pro-Western pressures from students and faculty at their universities, and that's been in the paper here as we've gone through the last couple of weeks. We expected more student unrest, actually, until the government really cracked down and threatened them to the point where they were not going to be able to protest at the level they'd want it to, but that time will come. I'll talk about Jordan a bit. You know, Jordan has been pro-Western. They were the first to recognize Israel in that region. They have a critical refugee situation at home with Palestinians. And then we look at Syria. You know, Syria is the home of Hamas. Hamas is based out of Damascus. They provide orders into Lebanon and into occupied territories with the terrorist acts that the Hamas execute or carry out. And Hamas really has two leaders. You know, they have an external guidance, and that comes from Damascus, and they have internal guidance, which comes from within. The formal name of Hamas, at least the English translation, is the Islamic Resistance Movement. Now, Syria is also facing significant international pressure to give up state support of terrorism, and we've put them on notice here in the last month. We'll take a look at Iraq, too. You know, we have a significant post-war stabilization effort ongoing there, and it's not going to be over for a long time. We are nation building. You know, some people say we are not empire building, but for sure we are in the undergoing the stresses of nation building in that state in the post-Saddam era. We'll take a look at Turkey also. You know, we're facing fundamentalist Islamic and Kurdish pressures in Turkey, pressures that they want to join the EU. We have France threatening to delay that. We have Italy and Spain promising to press for an early entrance of Turkey into the EU. They have severe inflation, and then, of course, they have a conflict within their government of which way they're going to go. And then Egypt is another key player in the Mideast. You know, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, they have severe economic stress. And then, of course, they have the fundamentalist problem in South Egypt.
Okay, and so it's certainly, this seems like sort of a hotbed, very unstable. And, of course, beneath all of that is this increasing influence of this radical form of Islam, which is totally contrary to the Islam that has existed predominantly for the last several centuries. Isn't this really tied into the Wahhabism of Saudi Arabia?
Yes, and not just Saudi Arabia, but for sure, that was some of the basis for the origin of the Al-Qaeda, and they embraced that philosophy, which is very conservative. And part of that, I think, has occurred because of the failures of the great Islamic civilizations of the past. And you look back in history and you see significant advancement in their civilization. It expanded over time and was a key player, up to Europe, into part of Austria even. And then you had the collapse, in the post-Ottoman era, and you have a significant decline in a relatively short period of time. And so you now have people who feel like they're failures. They have tremendous unemployment. They have a great disparity of the haves and the have-nots within all of the countries in the region. The literacy rate, ranges anywhere from a bit over 51% exactly in Egypt, up to around 78% in Saudi Arabia, 87% in Jordan. So you have problems boiling in that area. It's a cauldron that's just being stirred up. And you talk about the fundamentalism, the Islamic fundamentalism, the very radical version of that. And I would tell you that I firmly believe that is where we will fight the Third World War.
Well, I think
fundamentalists on the Islamic side and everybody else, which I call civilization.
But my impression is we're already in the Third World War. Certainly the head of the Israeli Mossad has said that. James Woolsey has talked about it. He calls it the Fourth World War. But, I mean, with our war with Afghanistan and Iraq, there are troops permanently stationed for all intents and purposes in the Middle East. I think we are already in the Third World War. Would you disagree with that?
No. No, I think we're in the opening battles. You know, Afghanistan was the first. The Iraqi campaign that has just finished its active phase, and now we're in the nation-building phase, is the second, and there are still many casualties to come, unfortunately. You know, God bless our soldiers, and everyone should pray for them. But that's just the beginning. I mean, this fundamental movement has the same mission for the civilized world as Hamas has for Israel. You know, Hamas's mission statement is to eliminate the Jewish state and replace it with a Palestinian state. And the Al-Qaeda, the fundamentalists out there, want to eliminate the civilized world and make it a fundamental Islamic planet that we live on.
Well, you know, I think that this is, seems pretty incredible for the average a listener to say that what are they talking about? And yet, at one time, the Muslim world was the greatest force in the world. I mean, they conquered all of North Africa. They'd conquered Constantinople. They'd invaded Europe up to Vienna, and the Battle of 1683 was the turning point. But had the Christian forces failed at Vienna, why, we'd all be speaking Arabic. I mean, they had invaded, had taken Spain. They were well into southern France. It was not until 1492 when, of course, the Muslims were driven out of Spain. But when they were the predominant culture in that area, they had a very advanced culture. They had tremendous literacy. They had tremendous advances as far as arithmetic and physics and all of these things. You know, you look at the magnificent architecture. Certainly a paralleling of the great architecture of Europe, wouldn't you agree?
I think if you have ever toured Egypt and have done the Nile tour or have looked at the pyramids south of Cairo, it's absolutely amazing. I think that their accomplishments, when they accomplished those beautiful monuments, is well above anything that occurred in Europe after that.
Well, you know, having seen the Mosque of Omar there, built about, I think, 692, somewhere there, the late 600s, there that stands on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, that is one of the most magnificent architectural buildings I've ever seen or been inside.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you see that again and again, whether it's ruins or partially restored ruins, but the magnificence, the size, and when you think about the mechanics that had to occur to build those items in the period in which they were built. You know, when you floated obelisks down or up the Nile, and then were able to stand them up. When you moved boulders that were carved and still weighed in multiples of tons, and you moved them with manpower and with ropes and some wheels and axles to place them as they did in the Great Pyramids, it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely overwhelming that a society could be so advanced, so refined in the mathematical aspect of it, in the engineering, and that then all collapsed into a point today where I go back and tell you that in Egypt we only have 51% literacy rate.
And of course, that really antedated the great Muslim empires. But be that as it may, certainly there was a great deal of culture here. And now you go in, and of course, it's just a poverty, or the majority of the people living in poverty. And then, of course, along come the radical Islamists and Islamists, and they say, look, follow us. We will return to Allah. We'll kill the infidels. We will rule the world again. And it sounds crazy. But, you know, when you're living in poverty or abject poverty, or you don't even necessarily have to be, they offer these people hope, and with their, of course, what I believe is a false religion, doesn't really matter. It's what they believe, and they're willing to fight and die for it. I mean, how many Americans are willing to fight and die to preserve America today? We ask our young men to go out and do it, but how many of the older people are willing to give up the comfort of everything they have to risk their lives to preserve liberty?
Well, I got to tell you that my parents served in World War II. My mom with the FBI, and my father in the European and Japanese theaters, and so they were. And my peers obviously were. And I think our young soldiers today, both men and women, have really done great credit, brought great credit upon themselves and our great nation. But you're right. I mean, we're a nation of haves, and we have a lot of diverse beliefs. And there are obviously more than a few people who are saying that no war is worth fighting for. And you counter that by what's happening in some of the nation states that I mentioned earlier and elsewhere in the world, Indonesia, for example, parts of Pakistan. You have a semi-literate group of people in many cases, and you have education that is preached by the imam, the religious leader, in the village, in the mosque, that is interpretation of the Quran, not, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And that just ferments that the conservative interpretation just ferments a gut feeling within those folks that if they can't have it, they're going to tear down what other people have, and that's the problem. It's not if we dumped all the money available in the civilized world into those nation states I mentioned today, or into the ones that are the biggest problem, and brought the standard of living up from, let's just take Syria, where it's $3,200, up to ours, or you know, 3,700 in Egypt up to ours, or Iraq, where it was only $2,500 per capita to ours, that still would not solve the problem. The elimination of Western culture and religion in nation states is what's going to solve their problem from their perspective. That's why I say, and I think you agree, that, you know, we may be in or about to start what will be a very, very lengthy world war, number 3 or 4.
Amen. Amen to that. And of course, the thing is that, you know, if you destroy the West, that's not going to make them any better off at all. They think it's going to, but it's really not. I mean, what we need to do is change their worldview, give them an entirely different perspective. And of course, it's their religion that gives them the fanaticism to honestly believe if they die, killing the infidels, then they're immediately going to go to paradise, and anything would be better than what they're in anyway. And that's why you see the suicide bombers in Israel, or you can see the potential for suicide bombers here in the United States.
And that's correct. But, you know, education is a key part of it. And I think a byproduct or something that contributes to that is communications. And we look at part of the nations that I've mentioned earlier on, and, you know, they have very few cell phones, very few Internet users. In fact, I would tell you last year in Iraq there were only 12,500 people online. That's amazing in a country of, you know, my goodness, we're talking...
what, about 40 million somewhere there?
Almost, yeah.
Okay.
24 million people by CIA count, you know, okay. 2002.
Well, they probably have a better count than I do. Anyway,
I tell you another problem we have in Iraq, you know, the growth rate's about almost 3%, but 41% of the population of Iraq is between the ages of 0 and 14. And that goes for Syria, where it's 39.3, Saudi Arabia, where it's almost 42.5%. So you have a tremendous group of youth who have been, you know, probably in the villages, lesser educated, more exposed to the imams, the men especially, in the mosques, and they get this brimstone and fire preaching of the imam about conservative Islamic values and a very conservative interpretation of the Quran. And these are the people that are going to be the soldiers of tomorrow, and some of them are the soldiers of today.
Well, you know,
the martyrs that you talked about, and the people willing to strap, you know, five pounds of explosives and 3 pounds of nails on their body and walk into a crowd.
You know, a friend of mine, Carol Matriciana, has put together a video. It's called The New Order, New Barbarians, and it's basically the video footage that's shown on Arab television to the people of the Arabian countries. And, of course, it's aimed at the children, aimed at convincing them that they should die in battle. And the pictures of the little children, they're marching. I mean, you're talking about 6, 8-year-old children marching with their weapons and, of course, being interviewed. Of course, it's in Arabic, but the captions underneath, I want to die, I want to kill the Jews, I want to kill the infidels. I mean, these are kids 6, 8, 10 years old, preparing now to die, and day after day, week after week, month after month, this is what they're seeing on Islamic television, being broadcast into their homes, into their minds. And, of course, this is really what's frightening.
Stan, it's going to take a full generation to counter the brainwashing that generation has undergone and the way they feel now. So if we could solve the Palestinian situation tomorrow, if everyone laid down their arms and lived happily ever after, you still have millions and millions of people who have been exposed to that from the time they were 3, 4, 5 on TV, or in the mosques when there wasn't any TV or radio. And you know, that's going to be tough to overcome. You know, I told you earlier, only 12,500 Internet users in Iraq. I mean, you compare that to, you know, a very modern country, let's just say Turkey. You know, 4 million people online. Cell phones, 17 million cell phone users in Turkey. I mean, we probably have that many in California. But that's a hope, though. I would tell you, as we get power to the rural areas, as people get cell phones and get online, for sure that would allow terrorist organizations to communicate and coordinate and attack in the short term. But in the mid and long term, that bodes well for a more modern form of government to evolve as the people are exposed to Western values. You know, and one of the countries that probably has the most exposure to the West has been Iran under the Shah. And you see what pressures the students and the faculty are now putting on their government and the debate within their own government between the prime minister and the president about which way they go. Do they stay conservative in the old Ayatollah Khomeini vein of what they want Iran to be as a leader of that Islamic world, or do they become more moderate and second, become secular perhaps?
But of course, certainly the majority of the women in Iran don't want this form of government because they're oppressed by it. Almost half the population of Iran, even perhaps more so than any of the other countries, is very, very young, 25 or less. So, I mean, they don't want these. So you've got the vast majority, I think, of the people there who do not want this radical form of government, and it's only been kept in power by hiring hooligans to come in from other countries and beat up the students there, and the students get out and demonstrate, and they're arrested or they're beaten up by these hired thugs that the government hires to put down the demonstrations.
Yes, that's true, but don't think that they have to hire them from elsewhere. They bring in Iranians, and they take their own people and make them thugs, and they go beat the students.
Right.
They do bring in folks from other countries. They've been a hotbed of terrorist training. The Republican Guard of Iran has provided training, and that's the home of the Hezbollah. And you can go to a nice terrorist training camp and get your BA in terrorist operations or demolitions 101 or whatever you want in Iran. And they export their training to the Bekaa Valley, where they have significant training camps. And that continues. But, yeah, they do suppress their own people that way. And I firmly believe that within the next couple of years, you will see significant change in Iran from within. Will there be some stimulus from outside? Absolutely. Do we have agents working? Do we have Radio Free America type broadcasts? Do we have education to try to modernize those folks? We do. But I think there's so much pressure from within, remembering that they had a full generation or two under the Shah that had Western values. They wore, blue jeans and Levi's. I don't know that they had any McDonald's when the Shah fell in 1979, but I wouldn't bet against it. And then they had this total suppression, including the significant suppression of the women. Only since 79 now. That's not been that long.
No, I know.
We're talking 24 years.
Well, of course, an awful lot of people fled there, certainly the Zoroastrians. A lot of people fled just literally for their lives. The Jews fled, the Zoroastrians, anybody that was not a Muslim, because, of course, they would face tremendous persecution. Why don't you tell us about Saudi Arabia? You lived there for 2 years, and, of course, you worked, of course, for the Saudi government. What's your impression about the situation there and the fact that you really have almost like a feudal kingdom, don't you?
Well, again, it's the only country of the seven I mentioned that doesn't have suffrage. Absolutely, it's a monarchy. It's ruled officially by King Fahd. In fact, his health precludes him from leading the country, and Crown Prince Abdullah is leading the country, along with other members of his royal family. But I would tell you, in my time in Saudi Arabia, I found the Saudis to be very benevolent. They were wonderful, warm, giving people. They were very social. I think every one of them smoked, and probably two-thirds of them drove a Mercedes. They had a great amount of wealth at the time I was there. They paid people $100 a day to sell newspapers. They had, three jobs for every Saudi, so they had to import significant labor, and they brought in what I would call semi-slave labor from third-world countries, and they brought in leadership, project management from France, from England, from the United States. To build most of what's been built in Saudi Arabia of the recent things. When they had that money, they had a great program to educate the Saudis, and in fact their literacy rate is about 78%, 84 for males and 70 for women. Women shared great wealth, though in fact they were covered when they went out in public, and they didn't drive. They didn't usually go to the mosque with the men either. They still enjoy their social life, and in fact, when we went to a Saudi's house for dinner, at the front door, it was pretty interesting. You'd be greeted by the door person, the doorman, and the men would go in one door and the women would go somewhere else. And all night, the men would socialize in a room and the women would socialize in a room, and at the end of the night, the couples would meet on their way out and go home again.
But isn't there tremendous oppression of women in the Saudi system? In other words, a woman is totally subservient to her husband. He can divorce her simply by pronouncing it. He can have four wives. And, of course, if you are on the outs with your husband, you're in real trouble as a woman. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if a woman is sexually assaulted there, she has to have four men verifying she's been sexually assaulted. In other words, she really has no rights at all as an equal citizen under the law.
I think it's not as bad in Saudi by any means as Afghanistan, where you can slap or beat a woman, and it's not a crime in most cases. That's a pretty simplistic statement there. But in Saudi, for sure, women don't enjoy all the freedoms of men. They have tremendous wealth. 40% of the national wealth is accrued to women. They, in case of sex crimes, they're challenged, and they're almost guilty until proven innocent, as opposed to our society, although in some cases I think we drag our victims through the fire too, and that's truly unfortunate. But I would tell you, going back to the time I was there, very benevolent. If you told a Saudi that you liked the lamp on his end table, he would give it to you and feel insulted if you didn't take it. Definitely. Now, let's talk about what's happened in recent times, though, as the money dried up. And not the money, really, but the cash flow, because the Saudis still have about a $36, $37 billion surplus. But the flow of that cash into the country has been a problem, and they don't have all that disposable income they used to have. And so now you don't have the freedoms and or the options that you had before if you were in Saudi, of leaving the country and going somewhere else to visit. You have, in the meantime, the Saudi government at the national level pursued a very aggressive modernization program, but they kind of gave the imams the village and the mosques. And so you had really two societies evolving. You had a modern cosmopolitan society inspired by Western architects and engineers and built by Sri Lankans and Pakistanis and Koreans and Sudanese. But then in the mosques and in the villages, you had, again, the brimstone and fire preaching of the imams that became the Al-Qaeda movement.
All right, fine. Well, of course, but what about the average person? Of course, we're talking about, the generosity of the members of the royal family. What about the average Saudi there who is not part of the royal family? What is their attitude? And, of course, that would be the vast majority, wouldn't it?
Well, most average Saudis, let's call a non-royal family an average Saudi, most Saudis only have one wife, not three or four. They can't have up to four at a given time. Crown Prince Abdullah, when I worked for him, he was on his seventh wife at that time, and having only a total of no more than four at one time. But the average Saudi is going to have one wife, not more than one. He's going to still be a pretty giving, gracious person, very humble. One thing that was pretty amazing to me in their national makeup, their psyche, was that, when we go and diverge for a moment from politics here, and let's just use swimming for an example, because a friend of mine was their national swimming coach. And he trained and worked his team, the Saudi team, to
go ahead.
And they, and let's just say it was, X number of seconds for the 100-yard butterfly. But once they did that one time, psychologically, they felt no need to maintain that level or do it again. And so he finally gave up in frustration and left the country. He said, I can get them to that point, but I can't instill in them in that society that they need to do that repeatedly to perform at that level. Way different than us. If you have someone who's running the 100-yard dash here and he's doing, 9.9s, he's working on 9.8 and he's going to be down to 9.7. That was a societal difference that I think is key from some of our Western values of competition. They are far more prone to accepting whatever is the way that it is. In fact, a member of the Saudi royal family shared with me that they truly enjoyed the modernization. They enjoyed the great Mercedes and other cars they were driving and the high-rises and the mansions. But he said, if it all collapsed tomorrow and oil was worth nothing, we would go back to the desert and fly our Falcons and enjoy our capsas on a tray, a communal tray, on a rug in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, it was a typical Bedouin lifestyle from which the Saudi Arabia family
and that's right.
came, Ibn Saud, right? All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. Here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton, retired from the military after, was it 24 or 28 years of military service?
Let's split the middle, 26 years,
all right,
Stan.
26 years. All right, fine. Well, of course, and, he's lived in Saudi Arabia, and of course, he's worked in Turkey, and of course, he has an excellent grasp of what's going on over there. What about Turkey now? Because, of course, we see recently, of course, the parliament has been taken over by the Islamic fundamentalists. The army is still, of course, trying to maintain their ties to Western culture and Western civilization, following along in the reform movement of Ataturk, but you seem to find, at least for the democratic representation, an increased move towards this radical form of Islam, which is so destructive to, you know, their advancement into modern society. What's going on in Turkey, and what should be done?
Well, you know, you hit it on the nail. You know, there's been a movement towards radical fundamentalism, and it's occurred in the villages. And the further east you go from that western seaboard, which I would draw a line from Istanbul to Izmir, you'll see more of that. It's probably a bit overstated, though there is a debate in their parliament, and they are becoming more Islamic in their focus than before. But, you know, they do have separation of church and state. I would tell you that, you know, after the coup of 1980, the military is firmly committed to sustaining a secular state. And though you have seen battles between the military and the civilian politicians and the debate within their parliament, I absolutely do not believe that the military would allow the nation-state of Turkey to go back to the pre-1980 era. Anyway, they have significant problems now with inflation. They really need the trade alliance of becoming part of the EU, and we have some sanctions against them that are unfortunate and unfair, I believe, that preclude them trading with us. But I think you'll see Turkey continue on a modernization and a pro-Western trend.
All right, because you call them a democracy, but as with so many democracies, yes, you can vote, you can put your people in office, but there is a ruling clique that are going to determine what really happens. Would that be a fair statement? And certainly this is what it would appear to be in Algeria, where the military, with our backing, controls the people. The Islamists won the election there some years ago. Maybe that was Algeria. The Islamic won the election, and we wouldn't let them have it. We financed the military. The same thing is true in Egypt, in my way of thinking, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, they supposedly have democracy, and they, of course, the president always gets 98% of the vote because they don't allow any opposition. Would that be a fair statement, a fair evaluation of what's going on? Or is this real democracy, or is this makes everybody feel warm, good, fuzzy democracy, but in reality you've got a ruling elite, and it doesn't matter what the people really want. We just want to give them the impression. They go to the polls, they vote every 4 years or 2 years or whatever, but we're going to control what's going on.
Well, I think, you know, in Iraq that was definitely true. You saw Saddam Hussein getting 99% of the vote. But in Turkey that's not true. You know, they have an emerging democracy. For sure it is not perfect. I don't think ours is perfect either. But your vote does count there. They have multiple political parties. Those political parties battle each other. There are three major parties. They have, you know, a Kurdish minority in the Far East that has some representation, and they're going to have to deal with that, and they are vitally concerned about what happens in Iraq, and if a Kurdish nation-state evolves out of the northern part of Iraq, that would not be in their national interest. And you've seen them move soldiers into that area and actually infiltrate special forces, special operations troops to protect their national interests, which is, you know...
In other words, we're protecting Turkey over the interests of the Kurds.
Well, I think, yes, I think that's a fair statement.
But why can't we let the Kurds have their own country? Why can't we give them the freedom, the ability to have their own country?
Well, you know, I don't know that won't happen in part of Iraq. I think the Turks don't want it to happen in part of Turkey.
Okay.
They also fear that if it does happen in Iraq, that the nationalism that evolves within the Kurds regionally might then promote demands on part of the landmass of southeastern Turkey, and that's not acceptable to the Turks.
But, I mean, the Turks have been down there killing off the Kurds, and, you know, repeatedly they've gone in almost with a genocidal ferocity.
You know, the Turks and the Kurds have been fighting for generations now, and I don't expect that to cease. The Turks have major elements of one of their armies in that region for control, and the Kurds are well organized and armed also.
Well, but then, Chris, there's really not going to be any democracy there as long as, you know, the people don't have the right to establish their own government. And, Chris, this is the problem we have, is that we seem to be imposing our view on how people should be living their lives and backing those who would deprive them of that right. I mean, the Kurds have always wanted a nation.
I don't disagree with that, but I think that, you know, Turkey is a nation state, and we've supported that nation state more or less, unfortunately, with the politics between the Turks and the Greeks. In the 710 agreement, we've not been able to be full players with the Turks, but I mean they have a problem of the Kurds in their sovereign nation state, and they're willing to let the Kurds play as a party within the nation state, but not as a terrorist organization in that southeast section, which part of the PKK does.
Okay, fine. Of course, the terrorists, I mean, we would call them terrorists because they don't go along with the government. They would call themselves freedom fighters, wouldn't they?
They probably would.
Okay, well, then, this is certainly a boiling cauldron up there. What about Egypt, where, you know, certainly the president there, you know, always gets all the vote. I mean, they just don't allow any opposition. That was the home of the Islamic Brotherhood. That was the beginning of this whole movement, even before Wahhabism became a major force. This was this fundamental Islam, but it's always been thoroughly suppressed by the Egyptian government with our help, and we're funding the people who are suppressing any effort to have any different form of government there. Would that be a fair statement or not?
Well, I think there's, you know, we have definitely given our support to the Egyptian government, and I think that's because we really view stability in that region as key to worldwide stability. If you look at the strategic location of Egypt, you also look at Egypt as embracing Israel early and being one of the hopes to bring peace to that region. The fundamentalists in the south, which is predominantly where they are, they infiltrate into Cairo occasionally, and there are isolated terrorist acts. But those fundamentalists are very, very conservative, fundamentally Islamic, al-Qaeda-type folks. And they don't want any Western presence, just as al-Qaeda doesn't. Al-Qaeda wants, you know, all the Americans and all the other foreign nationals out of Saudi, and by the way, off the rest of the planet, too, sooner or later. Thank you very much. I think the government of Egypt is a legitimate government. Mubarak has been an ally. He's gotten mixed signals from us because of our inconsistencies over, you know, the last couple of decades with our politics in that region. But in general, I think that he has modernized his country as best he can. You know, they have significant problems. They have 70 million people. They have a growth rate that, though not very high, only 1.7%, has outpaced their economic gains, and so that means more poverty. You know, a third of their people are, you know, 14 years of age or less. So they have problems they're going to have to have help with economically in terms of developing trade. They have a trade deficit. I told you earlier, they have $3,700 per capita income, which is low in that region. One third of Saudi Arabia, not quite as low as Iraq was, but other than Iraq, Syria and Egypt are down there at the bottom of the scale.
You know, we've traveled in Egypt a number of occasions, and they just look like they're just so angry. They're not happy people at all. At least this is my impression of what I saw in Egypt. What would your thought on that be?
Now, I've always seen the Egyptians, both the ones who worked in Saudi Arabia, and there were many, and the times I've been in Egypt, in Cairo and up to the Aswan Dam and throughout the country from there to the north, as being a bit less happy than some of the other folks in of Turkey, for example. Turkey's a frivolous, happy group of people, though they're almost a cashless society in the villages. But the Egyptians have always been a have-not nation. You know, they haven't had the resources. They don't have the resources now. I mean, they are oil poor. They have a little bit of oil, but they rely on textiles and tourism. And boy, tourism is in the tank. You know, it was in the tank within a recession before 9/11, and after 9/11, it got worse, and it hasn't improved significantly. So they're cash poor, and that's going to hurt them in terms of stability. And we've got to look and see how we can help that government maintain its stability and its presence, not by suppressing any of the fundamentalists in the south. I mean, they're doing that on their own when and where appropriate, although I think they let some of those villages in the very southern part of the nation go, just as the Saudis have ignored some of their small villages.
Well, you know, the thing is that once, as you alluded to early in the program, Saudi Arabia, Egypt was the greatest nation in the world. I mean, the pharaoh was the dominant force. The architecture, the accomplishment, the certainly the art, the culture, dominant in the world. You know, but this, of course, was 4,000 years ago. And look where we are. Look where they are today. And all they have in Egypt, to me, the impression I have, they got a glorious past and a miserable present.
I agree with that.
And of course, I have no idea what really can be done. What they need, of course, is, as you say, an economy. They need production. You know, they need to be able to enter into the modern world of exchange, and they seem to be almost locked in the past. And, you know, driving through the streets there, you know, the disrepair of so many of the apartment buildings, and they're just apartment building after apartment building, and the tremendous press of people. You know, and just living all on the very edge of poverty, not like it is in Africa, but certainly not the prosperity at all you see in Europe or here in this country.
No, it's a third world country. You know, they're probably never going to be in a position to own a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home that we enjoy. At the same token, though, I think if they continue to be very moderate in their interpretation of Islam, and if they look to the West for trade, that could well be their salvation. You know, again, the fundamental Islamic movement is a war we're going to have to fight. Egypt's going to have a choice of being part of that fundamentalism if the South, the Southern attitude prevails. I don't think it will. But if they can gain some better amount of stability and peace within that nation, they can then promote trade. You know, we look at all the trade, all of the production that has moved out of America to China, for example. And I think we're a bit short-sighted there, by the way. But if they had some of that from Europe, some of the production come to Egypt and other countries in the Mideast, that stability and that source of income would so significantly improve their level, their, you know, of living, their quality of life, that by itself would improve the stability within the region, or at least within Egypt.
Well, I think the greatest export is the people who want to move into Europe to try to have a better life, rather than staying in their own country. So, but what are we going to possibly do? I mean, here we are, we've got our troops over there. Certainly, I don't see our troops coming home. We were told they're going to come home as soon as the war is over, and, you know, the war is not going to be over. Now we're hearing 4 years they're going to be there, and I think they're going to be more or less permanently. I mean, I think we are committed to a long-range a battle. The first two shots have been fired in the Third World War. What should be done at the present time? Where are we going?
Let's talk about Iraq for a moment. I think we finally made the right move, albeit a bit late in Iraq. You know, we got Bremer in, and that was a step in the right direction. And now that we have a council of leaders in Iraq, excluding the Ba'ath Party folks, and they need to be excluded, they need to be destroyed, totally cut out of the future of Iraq in the short run, though they may resurface as a minority party after there's been a full, not only transition, but an establishment of a nation state in the post-Saddam era. But that council has got to be allowed to function now. It needs to be able to project its power into the villages and into the towns outside of Baghdad in terms of a police force for security, in terms of laws and a judicial system. And that alone, where we show that we are turning that country back to the Iraqis, we are going to be there to provide security as necessary in the interim, but with an exit strategy. And that exit strategy, unfortunately, may well be 4 years. It may be six. It may be seven. It could be three. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. It's going to be dependent on a couple of things. Number one, cutting that last bit of cancer out of the Ba'athists and the Saddam loyalists in that triangle from Baghdad to Tikrit up towards the Syrian border. And then, very frankly, we've got to either find a cold body or a hot body or cold body parts, if you will, of Saddam Hussein to put them to bed. Because there is still a suspicion, a notion of fear across that country that he's going to be there after we leave.
And I think that's a very legitimate fear. That
I think so, too.
And, of course, if you'd lived under Saddam Hussein, you'd be afraid to speak out. In fact, these men who are assuming positions of leadership are risking their very lives, aren't they?
They are. Absolutely, and because, you know, with the fear, that prevailing fear that that he may return, and with him the Baptists, and boom, they're back in power, the government is where it was, and everyone who has been visible in the interim, you know, era, immediately goes directly to prison, doesn't pass go, or maybe gets their head or their hands chopped off. So we've got to get him. You know, that's, and people are working to do that. You know, I believe he's probably alive. I believe they probably have good radio intercepts of where he has been, and they're tracking him down, and we won't rest until that's done.
But we can't even
the country's not going to rest until that's done either.
But we can't even find Osama bin Laden. We can't find Omar,
Muhammad Omar
over there in Afghanistan. So if we can't find Osama bin Laden with a big family, I don't know how many wives and how many kids he's got, we can't, are we really ever going to find Saddam Hussein? We can't even find the weapons of mass destruction that they told the American people that that they had. And of course, I think that upon my information we have from, I think, very reliable sources, they were moved into Syria. But of course, they don't want to tell the people that they'd move them out of there before we attack. Had you heard that?
You know, I had heard rumors to that. I'd also heard rumors that some were sold to Iran for their nuclear program. I would tell you that even if most of the weapons were deployed elsewhere, there will be remnants of that program that will become evident over time. How much time? I don't know, but we'll find remnants of that. And back to your question about, you know, finding Osama or finding Saddam, I think it'll be much easier ultimately to find Saddam because the box is smaller. If you look at the mountains of southeastern Afghanistan and into Pakistan, I mean, you could lose an army in there very easily, and you could also physically lose an army in fights in that area if you weren't careful. So we'll continue to pressure that area. We'll listen through cell phone intercepts and see if we can't track him down. For sure, we've been able to destroy the leadership of that organization. So the near term attacks that we're now thwarting and the ones that we may see, if any, come to fruition, are going to be from compartmentalized units acting semi-independently until they try to forge a new central organization. And we would like to think that we can, you know, probably get them as fast as they start to do that.
But of course,
with our listening capabilities.
But of course, the tragedy is that there still is totally instability over in Afghanistan. You seem to have, you know, a little stability in Kabul, and the rest of it is all controlled by warlords. No central authority, and of course, even the Taliban is beginning to reform. And of course, now you have clashes between Pakistan and Afghanistan. We say the war is over there, but it's not over for the people who live there.
No, I mean, and it's not been over for a long time. I mean, that country has been in a state of war for generations now. And if you look at the geography of the country and you look at the warlords, it's much like Europe was in the feudal period. I mean, you don't have a great ability to project a central government and full central control over that nation state given the geography and given the various factions. And so you're going to have warlords, and I think you're going to have an alliance of groups of warlords that are going to provide whatever stability we have in Afghanistan for some time to come.
Well, are you optimistic or godly optimistic with this new council they have in Iraq that they're going to be able to get the electricity going, they're going to be able to restore the water? Apparently you have electricity a couple of hours a day. You had electricity all the time under Saddam Hussein. Maybe you didn't have any freedom, but you had at least electricity and water and health care and a police force. You didn't have to be worried about, you know, being robbed at any time of day or night. We destroyed the police force, and of course, we had people, a member of the Baathist Party, who were willing to set up reinstitute the police, and we wouldn't allow them to do that. And now we have chaos, and I find it so difficult to believe that with all the smart people we have in America, we couldn't have foreseen what's happened.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, they didn't have power and water everywhere. In Baghdad, they had power most of the time, and they had good water supplies, but that was at the expense of cutting off, you know, over half of the population of Shiites in the south and not giving them any power or any water. So the situation wasn't great under Saddam by any means, especially if you weren't a Baathist loyalist, Baath Party loyalist. But I think you'll see now, and you probably read it in the paper, they're recruiting ex-police officers to come back. We'll reestablish a police force. When I say we, I mean the council, with American assistance and support. we're going about it the right way. We're just, you know, we started about a month and a half late. We could have been on the ground a bit earlier with this focus, and if that council had been established, you know, the 1st of May, it'd be a heck of a lot better than it being established, you know, in this past week. But that council will take a little time, and I do firmly believe, I'm not guardedly optimistic, I think I am optimistic, that they will survive and they will thrive. Will there be hiccups? Absolutely. It's a third world country. There are dissident factions that haven't liked each other for a long time. Remember that the Baathists had all the power, all the wealth, controlled everything. No one had any freedom. You know, there were very few cell phones, only 12,000 internet users. You didn't have freedom of movement if you weren't one of the elite Baathists from Tikrit or from the west side of Baghdad, as Saddam called home.
Well, I hope and pray that there can be a stability and that these unfortunate people can have an opportunity for a better way of life. Now, of course, what do you foresee? We keep talking about democracy. Oh, we're going to have democracy there. But if you have a democracy, you've got a majority of Shiites, and you'll have the Shiites, of course, in control over everybody else. So we can't really have democracy. We're going to have after the almost a Republican form of government, where it will be represented from the various groups, but not on majority rule. Majority rule would be chaos in Iraq.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a representative democracy,
okay.
A Republican form of government. We have the Shiites are about 60-65% of the country. The Sunnis are around 32-37. We have a few Christians, a few Jews. But I think you'll have a representative form of government that will reflect all of those groups, including the Kurds. And they'll have a say in that government. They do now. You have Kurds on that council.
And I think the thing is that you have to have a central government that can maintain order, but you've got to limit their power over the individual areas and let the Sunnis determine what they want to do, and the Shias determine what they want to do, and the Christians determine what they want to do, and the Kurds determine on what they want to do, and limit the power of the central government over the lives of the individual people. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
Stan, I think we should probably do a little bit more of that in America, too.
Well, I agree with you totally.
But, you know, you're right on there. I mean, we talk about a central government. It can't be a central dictatorship, because if you have that dictatorship, one party comes to the top as the cream, and they suppress everyone else. And so the government that evolves there, and the government that is in Afghanistan and will continue to evolve, is going to have to be one that grants significant autonomy to subordinate regions and leaders. And so you have the warlord that maybe controls, you know, 20,000 square kilometers in the southwest section of Afghanistan. You're going to have to be able to address the needs of the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Kurdish folks in the north, and be able to do that with some amount of fairness to create stability. Remember, though, that you have only a small percent of the folks were the haves in that country, so there were a whole lot of have-nots, and as they see power and water and the ability and freedom to move and money, where they can go to the market and buy things they couldn't ever buy when they were buying meat once a month, you know, for the last 15 years. That will enhance the stability of that region.
All right, now what about Saudi Arabia, though? That is the big question mark. What's going to happen to Saudi Arabia? That has certainly got this tremendous storehouse of oil for the world.
Well, yeah, the greatest known reserves in the world, 26% of the world's oil and a significant amount of the natural gas, though not quite as much as Iran has. I'll tell you what's got to happen in Saudi Arabia. First of all, we have to get to a point where they have free elections. It has to be initiated. I think it'll probably start in the villages and perhaps with a council of advisors to the royal family at national level. But then after it's initiated, it has to expand into the cities. Additionally, defense spending has got to be curtailed. The Saudis spend about 13% of their wealth, their gross domestic product. It has to go down to about half of that. You know, they're way over everyone else in the region at expense of giving the people what they need. The population and the increasing number of young people have got to be educated. Cell phones and internet access is going to help, I think, very frankly. And we've got to be able to get them to a point where they can talk to folks who have other values and see what is happening in other areas of the world, especially, you know, it could be critical for the women in Saudi Arabia, the young girls. Those things will help stabilize that country, and the royal family is going to have to give up some of their power to do that. And they're going to have to be the folks that initiate it, because they've got the power, and that's, you know, you need the power to do that, to initiate that, unless you have a revolution.
Do you think
we don't want a revolution.
Well, do you think they have the insight and the wisdom to relinquish power peacefully?
You know, I would hope so. I haven't spoken with them, so I don't have any insider knowledge there. But I would tell you that they are almost all Western educated. They have traveled around the world. They've talked to all the Western leaders. Their military leaders have gone to our schools and British military schools, and their populace has gone to UCLA and Berkeley and UVA, University of Virginia, and so I think the odds might be better than we would think.
What about, are they going to stop funding Al-Qaeda? Because they funded them before 9/11, they funded them after 9/11, 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, there's Osama bin Laden. Certainly they have been one of the major, that with Iran, as you mentioned, sources of funding for the Islamic terrorists. What are we going to do about that? The president has said, if you're funding the terrorists, why, we're not going to put up with it.
Yep, you're right there. I would tell you that the Saudis for a long time had this notion that they could buy folks off, and so if someone was a perceived threat to them, whether it was Hamas, Hezbollah, another nation state, by throwing dollars at them, they could make sure there was no internal threat, no domestic threat. Much to their surprise and then shock, Al-Qaeda did come into being, and then Al-Qaeda has now blown up things in Saudi Arabia. Not only do they have to stop providing funds for them by some wealthy Saudi families, and at the national level they are not funding Al-Qaeda, by the way, but they have to go out and attack and kill Al-Qaeda. They have to grab that snake and cut its head off.
But do they have the will to do that? Because if they did, they'd have the clerics after their heads.
Well, that's going to be a battle. And remember what I said back in the 80s, the royal family kind of ceded the mosques and the villages to the imams, who then preached that brimstone, hot Islamic fundamentalism. In some cases, not every case, they're going to have to undo that. They're going to have to take and export democracy, export councils in towns and cities and regions, and then a national council, and facilitate national elections, and then renegotiate the royal family's position in all of that, to maintain Saudi Arabia as we know it today. And that's probably not quite the right word. It's going to change significantly, but it's not going to be a revolution. If they don't, and if Al-Qaeda gains preeminence without any big amount of funding, then you'll see the potential in Saudi Arabia for a revolution, and that would truly be unfortunate. It would not be in anyone's national interest except the Islamic fundamentalists, who see a pan-Islamic world at the expense of everyone who's not on their side of the fence.
Well, our guest has been Lieutenant Colonel retired Jerry Stratton. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we can get you onto some of our other programs. You have a great deal of insight, and I think a great deal of knowledge. I'd like all of our very audiences to hear it.
Stan, thank you very much. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview tonight with Lieutenant Colonel Stratton. I think that the people who recommended him were right on. I think he's got a tremendous insight and understanding of what's going on over there. And so we will try to get him to our other stations as well. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Hope you begin to see that the quagmire we're in World War III. The average American doesn't understand that. But, of course, America is going to be changed tragically forever. And, of course, your job is to understand what's going on and understand, in my way of thinking, the spiritual forces of which are motivating this whole thing. And, of course, their ultimate goal, a new world order, a new world religion. Well, pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Pray for revival. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.